Welcome on a beautiful Thursday afternoon. We've got a couple of House bills we're going to do first. And with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2460 and ask that Jan Coleman and Ron Nichols come forward, please.
Yeah, did you put your name down?
Pardon me?
Maybe you put your name down. Not on this bill.
Oh, that could be.
You can talk on this bill.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Chairman, Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Coleman. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk.
Thank you.
And I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks today. This is short and sweet. Basically, we're looking to repeal ORS 194.045, which basically gives the county clerk's power to certify the status of a notary. But in order to do that, we have to call the Secretary of State where the notaries are housed and find if that person really is a notary, and then either get a verbal or written verification in order to be able to do this. The county clerks years ago did keep the notary records in their offices, but that went away. The very last vestiges of it went away in 1989 when actually they took away our power to certify from any record we had. And the last records we had were just if a notary brought in their certification to our office and had we made record of it, then we could certify them. So that was what was taken away in 1989. And from that time on, we've had to call the Secretary of State to verify with them if the notary was really a notary so we could certify that. Virtually, we just don't do this anymore. And so we're looking to have this part of the statute repealed so that the Secretary of State, who actually keeps the record, could do the certification.
Yeah. Because we have a centralized system and it's all there.
You bet.
Questions? Public hearing, House Bill 2460, open work session, House Bill 2460.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
House Bill 2460 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2460 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Deckard. That way I'll get you on the floor on time. You get to carry this one, 2460.
Now, what kind of comment is that?
I agree.
It's an accurate one.
I agree. Well.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2590A. And Susanna Knight. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator Metzger and members of the Senate Committee. My name is Andy Leisinger. I'm a landscape architect and chairman of the Board of Landscape Architects. And we're here today. Oh, by the way, I practice here in Salem, Oregon at 340 Leslie Street, Salem, Oregon 97301. And we're here today to kind of ask for a housekeeping change to a statute, ORS 671.376. We'd like to change that into a rules. We are one of the semi-private independent agency here for the state of Oregon that regulates landscape architects. And our renewal dates by statute are October 31st. And what we'd like to do, just because it would help staff and cash flow for being a small agency, because we only have a part-time person on board, is to change that to a rule. So we could change our renewal dates to the time that if I became licensed in July, I could be every year be changed to July. And basically, it would help the staff not be slammed with everything coming October 31st with all these registrants coming in and dealing with all that, and then we have to add staff and so on. So basically, that's kind of what we're here to ask you. And also, one of the last paragraphs there is that we're requesting an emergency clause be added to this bill that would allow the agency to implement the change billing cycle this calendar year if the bill were to become law. And we just ask for your support and hope you would vote for this change.
Okay, well, thank you. And the emergency clause is in there now. Do you have some things you'd like to add?
Not really, but I'll be happy to say a few things. My name is Susanna Knight. I'm the administrator for the board. The reason that this bill had to come about is because during the interim, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee did a review of 15 models of government, 8 of which were semi-independent boards. And in that audit, this board was found to be deficient in their rules and in their laws, and we're trying to correct those deficiencies now. And this is one of the deficiencies that was pointed out in the report that Adrian Sexton prepared for that committee. And it's a real critical piece for us to getting back on track to making things right at the agency. The administrator that was previously here left shortly after the audit came out, and so I came on board December 1st. So I'm just trying to get them through all these issues that need to be corrected, and this is a very big one because it's important for the financial stature at this moment to be sure that we can get this changed right away.
Okay, so we're going to move, like our driver's licenses and other agencies, and when they expire, that's when they do them, rather than throw the big ton on you at the end of, or the 1st of October.
Right.
Okay, questions for either? Smooth sailing. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2590 and open a work session on House Bill 2590.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2590A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2590A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Mona Sanderson, would you carry that bill?
I would love to.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1008. And members, as you know, we've had this bill for us a number of times last month and a half or so. When we last heard this bill on last Thursday, there were a number of people that did not get to testify, and I said they could testify first before we begin, and I want to be true to that. So Libby Henry, if you would like to come forward. You were next in the queue on Thursday. You're now first in the queue. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Libby Henry. I'm representing the Eugene Water and Electric Board. And with me today is Larry Cable. Larry's EWEB's attorney on matters that concern the Trojan nuclear facility and has been for many years. We're here today with an amendment that is in the bill. It's in the very end of the bill, the last couple pages. And the intention of that amendment is to assure that if whatever parties or party assumes responsibility for PGE through a purchase or any other means, they would take their proportionate share of the Trojan facility's liabilities and assets. Three of us own Trojan. EWEB has 30%, Pacific Core has 2.5%, and PGE has 67.5%. So this is just insurance policy that whomever does take the plant does assume that percentage share. There's a lot of unknowns around what's going to happen, not only with PGE, but also all the kind of regulatory actions that come to play when the transfer of a site certificate or a license, a nuclear license, is transferred. So I'm going to let Larry speak to that, but that's the purpose of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think it's basically what Libby...
Please identify yourself.
Oh, excuse me. Larry Cable. Cable Houston, attorney for EWEB. What we are proposing is basically what Libby just went through, which is regardless of whether PGE would be acquired, for example, in an asset purchase or in a stock purchase or in a combined purchase, however it is acquired, there would be a requirement for the next owner of PGE to assume the same liabilities that PGE has in connection with Trojan, which is generally to deposit certain monies that are scheduled to be deposited into a trust fund, which is accumulating which may need to be supplemented because the fuel has to stay longer. We can't get it off. So the reason that we think it's a prudent thing to do is because we just don't know whether it's Oregon Community Power or Portland or however it might be acquired. We don't know the precise structure or mechanism by which it will be done. So what this allows is to clearly get the Trojan liabilities assumed, which will in turn, I think at least, expedite the possibility of a transaction going together. So that's basically it. I'd be happy to answer any questions that any of you have, but that's what we're proposing.
Mr. Cable, the language that I see referenced to that is in the Dash 8 Amendment, page 46 and 47. Does that satisfactorily meet the request that you have?
Yes, that was the language that Mr. Cable drafted for us.
Thank you. Questions for our friend from Eugene? Okay, thank you.
I just one closing comment. This language has been shared with the customer groups, City of Portland, PGE, Pacific Board, the Oregon Department of Energy, the Energy Facility Signing Council is okay with it. Everyone I could think of, and I don't know of any problems with it.
Well, that's good. It's probably one of the few things we'll have that we can say that about, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Who else did I didn't get to? Ken Strobeck was next. He's not here.
With Andrew
Bidambos. You're going to go in order. No, I'm kidding. Come on. She doesn't look like Ken Strobeck, but she works for the same folks, so she gets to be him today. Nice to see you on something other than transportation, Andrea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Yes, thank you. I'm not Ken Strobeck. Fortunately, he couldn't be with us today. Andrea Fogue with the League of Oregon Cities. I'd just like to make a few comments about Senate Bill 1008. We have been working with the folks that have been diligently putting this bill together. And a thank you in particular, because from the beginning there has been real conscious effort to make sure that our franchise fees and taxes, privilege taxes, the agreements we have in place retain or are in place. For us, that's extremely important because, in particular, franchise revenues are typically the first or second largest revenue source for a city. They go to pay for all those things that citizens and businesses need and expect, all the sexy water, wastewater, parks and libraries, those types of services that all of our citizens rely on. A couple of things I'd just like to point out in our testimony. The League, of course, represents all the incorporated cities in Oregon, 240 of them. We have our newest member, Damascus, that incorporated in November. We have 52 cities within the service territory of Portland General Electric, but would also like to point out that we are interested in what happens outside of the service territory as well, because we have cities that have significant interest and tax-based issues with the assets of Portland General Electric. So we're definitely still representing all 240 of our cities. And as you'll see, we have a set of principles that have been developed and approved by our board of directors with regard to any purchase of Portland General Electric. And a lot of these things are issues that you've heard from other folks, retaining low-cost energy, consumer protections. I mentioned our franchise fees, privilege taxes, et cetera. With regard to Senate Bill 1008 specifically, one of the things that the League has been working on is ensuring that the language in the bill meets the intent of protecting our franchisees, privilege taxes, et cetera. So we are working on amendments. Some of that language is included in the Dash 8 amendments, and some of it we are still working on. And the other issue, of course, for us is governance, because we think it's very important that the governance structure, particularly the nominating committee, include folks that are elected that represent the citizens, residents, taxpayers, have been elected by those folks. to look out for their interests. So we think a blend of the consumer groups, businesses, governance in terms of the city and county folks is a really good way to approach the governance structure. And so you will see in the Dash 8 amendments that we have been added to the nominating committee, and also as a criteria for the board members that ultimately the governor would select, we think experience and expertise in policy development is an important addition, and that's been added in the Dash 8 amendments as well. So specifically, those are some things that we have been working on with Senate Bill 1008. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions? Has the League taken a position on the City of Portland's attempt to purchase?
Mr. Chair, for the last 2 years, really, since the City of Portland has been pursuing potential acquisition of Portland General Electric, the League has been involved in that process. You may recall that there were roundtables set up to try to engage folks region-wide. The League helped to facilitate those roundtables. There's now an advisory commission that is in the process of selecting potential pool of board members that would be recommended to the Portland City Mayor. The League is actively participating in that. Actually, Ken Strobeck from the League and the Mayor of Portland, Salem, Janet Taylor, are our League representatives to that commission. So all along, we have been participating in the process. We really want to see a solution that is good for Oregon, and really that brings PGE home, you know, if we can. So, and as you'll see, our principals have set forth very specific criteria that we want to see in any publicly owned utility, and the City of Portland's proposal is consistent with that. We have been working very closely with them in terms of they meet all of that criteria, so we absolutely support the City of Portland's proposal and their work that they've done so far, and particularly over time. You know, they've done a lot of due diligence, and they have much of the you know, financing pieces in place and in terms of where they're at in their process.
Questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the League taken a position, Andrea, on public versus private? I mean, the direction we're on right now is that Enron, the bankruptcy process, is going to redistribute the stock, and it's become
right.
It will become eventually a PGE like we all knew and for the most part liked prior to being purchased by Enron. Does the League have a position on public versus the route that the entity is on currently heading toward?
We do not have a position on public versus private. However, we see some real benefits to public ownership in terms of potential rate reduction. And one of the things that I think both Senate Bill 1008 and the City of Portland's proposal would accomplish, particularly we've got some very sound studies and a lot of research that's gone into verifiable numbers from the City of Portland showing a rate reduction that would occur with a public purchase of the utility. And so that's something we would really like to see, and I think a benefit that we see in a public purchase versus, you know, we haven't seen that, for instance, with the TPG process, that would have accomplished the same type of rate reduction for ratepayers in Oregon.
Just wanted to follow up,
but we have not taken a position. I mean, it depends on the individual proposal, public versus private ownership.
Has the League considered or contemplated or perhaps even made taken a position on having the ratepayers, those that actually pay the bill, having them have an opportunity to voice their opinion on whether they think that either the City of Portland or the state ought to be able to purchase PGE? I'm talking about basically a ratepayer vote to approve such a purchase?
We have not taken a position on that. However, there is, I know, another proposal floating out there, Senate Bill 671, Oregon Mutual, that would kind of contemplate that one meter, one vote as a component of their proposal, if I understand that correctly. I can also tell you that there are governance structures across the country that vary. And, you know, municipal, and that we've looked at for public utilities.
Is there any reason to believe that the league would not support letting the public have a say, have a vote, just in what you know about how the league operates?
Well, to be honest with you, Senator Starr, I think we would really need to take a close look that would all be tied into whatever the governance structure ended up being, if it were because I assume you're talking about a public utility.
I'm talking about if the utility goes public, either
the utility goes public,
or coalition of governments, or the state of Oregon purchases PGE, should the ratepayers have the ability to say
directly
yes or no on that idea or not? And does the league believe that the public ought to have a voice in this process?
The public definitely needs to have a voice in this process. We think that they will have a voice in this process, whether it's a public process through the legislature or whether it's a public process through the city of Portland. Everything we do is open public process. But in terms of one person, one vote, I think we would need to look at that in the context of the governance structure and how we set that governance structure up.
Nice sidestep. That was good.
Other questions?
Well, Senator Starr brings up a good question. PGE's, in terms of its load in the city of Portland, is only 12 to 13% of their load is the city of Portland. 25.3% of their meters are in Portland, and all the rest of it is elsewhere. So there are, by far, the majority of ratepayers are outside that jurisdiction.
Correct.
They are all within our jurisdiction. And then the question would be, you know, their representation through the legislature or through individual votes. So that is an interesting point.
I will, if I could just add to that comment, the city of Portland has been diligently working with those surrounding communities to make sure that they're engaged in the process, that they have a voice in the process. Again, we had those series of roundtable meetings, and the process that's set up, you know, right now, I think very much encourages those other cities in particular and counties that are served by PGE outside of just the city of Portland to very much be a part of this decision-making process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We had two other people that I said I would get to before we began, and the next round, Liz Trojan was on that list on Thursday. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Metzger, Senators, I'll be really brief. I'm with the Oregon Public Power Coalition. My name is Liz Trojan.
Why don't you come to the other mic? For some reason,
mic better.
I'm not getting the projection as much.
Can you hear me now? Chair Metzger, Senators, I'm with the Oregon Public Power Coalition. My name is Liz Trojan, and we're a grassroots group whose goal is public ownership of our local utility. We're backing the City of Portland's efforts because they have the votes to make this happen. In light of the governor's announcement yesterday that he's backing the City of Portland, we're a little surprised that this bill is consuming time on your busy agendas. We have a golden opportunity to form public ownership of our local utility, a large utility that holds the key to Oregon's economic success. We need to keep in mind who our opposition is. It's not the City of Portland. It's the next leverage buyout firm, whoever they may be. And, of course, with the current energy bill, a possible repeal of PUCA. We need for this purchase to happen. It is long overdue. What a disappointment if we fail because of an intergovernmental squabble. Senator Starr isn't here right now, but I wanted to, he was talking about putting this to a vote of the people. I can tell him exactly what would happen if it went on the ballot. PGE spent $3.5 million opposing the Multnomah County PUD when it was on the ballot. We as a grassroots volunteer effort took in $35,000, which we thought was pretty good for a grassroots effort, but we couldn't afford the television time that PGE could. So, that's all.
Thank you. A couple of points I would say.
Sure.
About your last point, about the money. There was a mayoral candidate that didn't have much money. He won overwhelmingly, so it's not necessarily...
Yes, even Tom Potter recognizes that he was an anomaly.
So
Chair Metzger.
The messages are. And then the other one, just a point, just to be clear, in recognizing your initial point about consuming our valuable time, this is the valuable time that we do with the citizens, regardless of whether this is your point of view or not. And regardless of what the governor says, the only legislation that happens is from the two chambers in this building. It does not happen in the center office. And we will be deliberative on this issue on behalf of our citizens, both in our districts, the ones that you represent, as everyone else. So thank you for your comments.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, and the last one was Sandy Flicker. Sandy. And joining us up the dais is Representative Berger. So we welcome her to the committee today.
Thank you, Senator, for your...
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Representative Berger. For the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, representing the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And with me is Tom O'Connor, representing the Municipal Electric Utilities in Oregon. First, I would like to thank Senators Deckert and Nelson and Representative Berger for working with us to resolve some extremely important issues for consumer owned utilities, as many different proposals are being discussed regarding the future ownership of PGE. There are 36 consumer-owned utilities in Oregon, serving about 25% of the population. These are utilities that are extremely small, and they serve the very smallest communities in Oregon. They are financially, operationally, and physically integrated with the investor-owned utilities, all the investor-owned utilities. We have joint ownership of generation facilities, we have contractual relationships, and we have shared distribution and transmission lines. It is very important to us that all the utilities in Oregon are operationally successful. Oregon's consumer-owned utilities are, for the most part, distribution utilities. They are exclusively dependent on Bonneville Power for their supply of power. That holds true for the electric cooperatives. There are a few other consumer-owned utilities that do have some generation, but the electric cooperatives have no other generation facilities. They're dependent on BPA for their power supply. We purchase BPA at preference rates by federal statute. Also by federal statute, PGE small farm and residential customers receive what is called the residential exchange, so they can also benefit from the BPA system. Consumer-owned utilities subsidize that exchange. The residential exchange is negotiated at the regional level because, as you know, Bonneville is a regional resource. Currently, BPA has power sales contracts with consumer-owned utilities, and these contracts are up for renewal in 2011. New contracts will be negotiated at that time, as will the residential exchange. It is important to note that following 2011, BPA has announced that their power supply is fully allocated. There will be no excess power available from BPA. Co-ops and municipal utilities have only one primary concern in Senate Bill 1008, and we've worked with Senator Deckert and the working group to address this concern. We would like to be held harmless should PGE change ownership in any way, be purchased by any other entity. That means that there will be no rate impact on consumer-owned utilities as a result of a change in ownership of PGE. It also means that current contractual relationships and territorial allocation statutes remain the same. The now, I guess, -8 amendments ensure a hold harmless policy. They allow consumer-owned utilities to continue to purchase preference power from BPA, and they allow PGE customers or Oregon Community Power customers to continue to receive rate relief from the residential exchange. Absent these provisions in Senate Bill 1008, we believe there will be a negative rate impact on existing customers of consumer-owned utilities. Co-op rates are already higher than PGE rates, and if PGE rates decrease, there will be even more of a rate difference between rural and urban Oregon. I know some of you are very aware that co-ops serve less than one customer per mile of line in most of their service territory. We appreciate the support of these amendments and want to assure that with these specific amendments in Senate Bill 1008, the co-ops and the municipal electric utilities are neutral on Senate Bill 1008. We do believe in local control, and we believe it's the right of the citizens that are located within the PGE service territory to decide the ownership of their utility. However, we have an extremely important issue, as I said, and that is the impact on the consumer-owned utility customers. Senator Deckert stated that he believes Senate Bill 1008 should provide a benefit to PGE ratepayers, and I know that Senator Deckert and the legislature would not want those benefits to be achieved while disadvantaging small rural utility customers in Oregon. This is a very difficult issue for us, and it's been very difficult for us to come to a place where we have to ask for support from the legislature for the amendments that we have proposed. We believe it is the only way at this point that we can assure there will be no rate impacts. PGE is a huge utility with huge resources. They have the ability to generate resources. They have the ability to build new resources for generation. They will have tax advantages should they become a publicly owned utility. Please remember that electric cooperatives serve sometimes only 1,500 people. We're small distribution utilities, and we have one asset that allows us to provide a rate to rural Oregonians that is somewhat competitive with the rest of the state and allows us to make sure that rural Oregonians are not more disadvantaged in this very basic service that's provided in Oregon. And that is our access to Bonneville Power. And any way, shape, or form that access is changed and we do not receive the same access that we have today will cause rate impact. And within the last 4 years, we had a 46% rate increase when Bonneville was overallocated. We know what happens. And that rate increase is passed on to those customers in rural communities in the state. So we're just coming to you to say this is what we need to have happen on behalf of the customers that we represent. We're asking for your support for that, and with that support, we wish you the best of luck in determining the kind of legislation that that should move through this process in terms of the future ownership of PGE. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything you'd like to add? Okay. Questions?
Comments?
Senator Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it has been a pleasure to work with Sandy and Tom on our work group, and my only request to them is, as we add the Dash 8 amendments at their request, that they continue to work with Mr. Cannon and Mr. Eisendorf on a discussion that I think is fruitful and keeps options as it moves towards the House available to us just in the preference power and governance arena.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll return now to the top of today's agenda and ask that Brad Cleese, Jason Eisendorf, and Gary Conklin come forward. I believe you're going to give the overview of the 10008-8 as it's dash-aided. And by the way, I very much appreciate, members, that you should have this here. If not, could you get your copy?
Is this the Dash 8?
Yeah. Appreciate this format. I think this is a good way to connect all these dots. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Conkling. I'm here today representing Washington County. And as you've noted, Jason Eisendorfer with CUB and Brad Van Cleve representing the industrial customers for Northwest Utilities are here. And we were asked to make a formal presentation of what's in the Dash 8 amendment. And as you've already noted, Jason has provided you a matrix that breaks down the sections. And what I thought I would try to do and also summarize them, what I would try to do is just help you walk from the beginning to the end fairly quickly with what's where the stuff is, and he's annotated it for you, so you can use my oral commentary and his point. I have one section that I'm going to fill in a little bit of the blank on. It's the section 19 that I asked Legislative Council for assistance to all those sites that are there that I'm sure someone would probably be curious what it is that they reference. So, with your leave, Mr. Chair, I'll just go ahead and I'll move along and let you ask questions at whatever stage you want to ask them, but I'm going to just try to basically move through the bill that way. Section 1 deals with definitions. Section 2 deals with really the creation of Oregon Community Power as a public corporation, and it lays out its mission, and that mission relates to reliable, low-cost electricity. Section 3 relates to the tax exemption. Again, the tax exemption is qualifying for federal and state income tax exemption. Section 4 relates to the board nominating committee and its purpose. Section 5 deals with who serves on the nominating committee, and I might note that the Dash 8 amendments do include a representative from the cities and counties, which, as you recall, Senator Nelson, when he testified here last week, indicated that the group working on this had agreed to. Section 6 deals with the Board of Directors, which is a 7-person Board of Directors appointed by the governor. Section 7 deals with the terms of those board members. Section 8 deals with the timeline of the gubernatorial appointments. Section 9 deals with board responsibilities. Section 10 deals with board guidelines, such as meetings, selection of a chairman, quorum, and compensation. Recall that there was a question about this, and these board members are anticipated to have compensation. Maybe one of the most important sections in the bill is Section 11, which lays out the powers that Oregon Community Power has. They broadly include the ability to conduct business as a utility, to execute contracts, to issue bonds, to sue and to be sued, to service debt, to encumber debt and to service debt, to set electricity rates, to build and acquire generating facilities, enter into intergovernmental agreements, to periodically develop a least cost resource plan, to hire and fire employees, set salaries, enter into franchise agreements in lieu of payments, eminent domain powers, which I'll talk about in a moment in a little more detail, and also the ability to deal with energy contracts. Basically, the powers that you would anticipate for a professionally run business like utility. Section 12 is also, I think, a very important section because it deals with the basis of rates. It says that they are to be cost-based rates, which is an important standard, I think, to have in statute. It also indicates what legitimate costs include, and I won't run through them, you can see, but it's a fairly straightforward, transparent description of what those rates might be. It also indicates that there is non-discrimination among classes of customers in those rates. And for customers, these are very valuable and important statements as to the rate structure and ultimately evaluating whatever rates might be and rate modifications. Section 13 deals with the rate setting process. And again, as I think the customer representatives last week testified, they spent a fair amount of time developing a process that really spans or really bridges the two worlds between a public utility commission rate setting review for an investor-owned utility versus a more open environment where you have an elected set of board members from a customer-owned utility. This is a process that is really a trimmed-down PUC process, but it is a process that involves an evidentiary record of where there's really fact-finding and there's an independent administrative law judge. So it is not done on just sort of anecdotal information. It's basically done on a written record as the Public Utility Commission currently handles its rate setting matters. Section 14 deals with rate-setting rules. Section 15 is one of great interest to a number of people. It deals with eminent domain. In general, Oregon Community Power would have the ability to exercise eminent domain in the conduct of business, but not to acquire exclusive service territory from either an investor-owned utility or a customer-owned utility.
And so, Gary... Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
So what was the rationale? I remember it, but what was the rationale on eminent domain and those provisions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I think it's purely to make sure that this doesn't appear to be a the basis for a hostile takeover of other utilities, regardless whether they're investor-owned or customer-owned utilities, but it is really to respect the PGE exclusive territories itself.
Okay.
Remaining in the eminent domain world, these provisions also do not permit the use of eminent domain to acquire non-electricity utility assets. So that's another restriction. The powers in general do not come into being for Oregon Community Power until it actually acquires PGE, with one exception. And that exception is contained in Section 21, which I'll just reference here, I think, for convenience, which is in a negotiated settlement with the seller. If for some reason both the seller and the buyer agree that there are reasons, advantages, whatever they might be, for an eminent domain proceeding, then and only under that circumstance would Oregon Community Power be able to exercise eminent domain power in the acquisition of PGE. I don't know that that's likely or unlikely. I myself couldn't attest that there are any reasons for that, but there were enough people who thought that there could be a reason to at least create that relatively narrow exception that only applies when there is, it's basically done by consent. Section 16 requires at least an annual independent audit. Section 17 is the section that relates to holding local governments harmless, that the League of Cities testified that they are continuing to work perhaps on perfecting the language. And in this particular case, that we view that as a friendly activity. The goal here is, in fact, to hold them harmless. So we want the language to be perfect, so we're pleased that they are doing that. Section 18 makes clear that the Oregon Community Power has status as a customer-owned utility. Now let me turn to Section 19, which is the section that relates to many of the things, and these are just legal sites, and I ask Legislative Council to give me what those sites reference, and I won't read them all, but I'm going to give you some of the most important ones. The section, subsection 1 relates to the powers that it has. Subsection 2 relates to the powers that it, or the laws that don't apply. So under subsection 1, the laws that do apply, they include eminent domain procedures, intergovernmental agreement procedures, public records laws, public meeting law, government standards and practices, code of ethics, conflict of interest procedures, requirements for depositories of public funds, tort actions against public bodies, public agency opportunities for minority, women, and emerging small business, municipal privilege tax on public utilities, employment transfers of public employees and procedures, collective bargaining procedures, property tax treatment of publicly owned property. Those are the laws that do apply. Subsection 2 lists those that do not. And they include State Agency General Procedures, Administrative Procedures Act, PERS, State, I'm not going to read these all, State Lands Law, DAS Oversight of Public Facilities, Public Contracting, Prevailing Wage Law, DAS Oversight, Public Employee Salaries, Secretary of State Audits, Attorney General Management of Eminent Domain, Legislative Assembly Review of Administrative Rules, State Archives role as their custodian of public records, notification requirements for bid requirements, employee benefit plan requirements, and mandatory safe worker compensation coverage. So SAFE will not be required to be their carrier. So those are section, part of Section 19, and I thought you would appreciate that. While we have, I think, other witnesses have referred sort of generally to some of those provisions, I thought you would appreciate having more specific. And if you have any ones that I didn't mention, I'm glad to go with the list that Dexter Johnson provided. Section 20 of the bill provides authority to negotiate and buy PGE. Section 21 authorizes the Public Utility Commissioner, to allow an adjustment in rates to pay for costs such as due diligence and other costs that involved in the purchase of a PGE. Section 21A sets up the Oregon Community Power Utility Acquisition Fund to aid in that purpose. Section 22 indicates that the authorities contained in this statute are sunsetted in the middle of 2009. Section 23 is broadly aimed at dealing with successor interests. Its purpose is principally to make sure that it's clear that Oregon Community Power could step in and carry out functions of PGE and, in fact, assume many of its responsibilities, obligations, even its rates. Section 24 is the provision that Ms. Flicker referred to that deals with preference power, balanced interest between consumers, and this is the provision that she and others in the customer-owned utility community recommended. We then go into a longer group of them of sections from Section 25 really through Section 35 that principally deal with provisions relating to Senate Bill 1149, Oregon's Competitive Electricity Restructuring Bill. Section 29 deals with public purpose charges. Sections 30 through 35 deal with large customer direct access. These provisions, as I again believe that customer witnesses last week testified, turned out to be more sophisticated, more complicated than originally thought, even though the purpose was easy. It's not absolutely easy to make these happen. And as you recall, customer-owned utilities are exempted from the provisions of Senate Bill 1149, and so this would be an unusual situation where, as a customer-owned utility, Oregon Community Power would be obliging itself through statute to comply with all of the components of that act. So these provisions essentially carry that out. Section 36 might seem like sort of a throwaway, but it's actually critical in that by statute it maintains the exclusive service territory for Oregon Community Power that currently PGE now has. And this is, I think, for the protection of this utility and having its own service territory. Sections 37 through 45, by and large, deal with bond-related issues. And we can talk about them in more detail if you want to, but they fundamentally the bond provisions. Section 46 deal with the Trojan liability provisions, and again, as Ms. Henry and Mr. Cable indicated, the goal here is to essentially maintain the status quo and the obligation that PGE currently has relative to Trojan as Oregon Community Power moves forward. And Section 47 is an emergency clause. So, Mr. Chair, that is what this amendment does. And let me just, before I allow my colleagues to add or subtract to whatever I said, just indicate that having worked on this general subject, starting with Willamette Valley Power, and subsequently last session working somewhat between an idea, conceptual idea similar to this, and working with the City of Portland on its proposal. I think from my vantage point, this is the most complete rendering of provisions relating to how you would set up an organization that could be positioned not only to buy, but to run a utility like PGE. and do so as a publicly owned utility. I don't believe anywhere else that I'm aware of, or is there a set of provisions written down in writing that people have vetted that have that character to them. And so many people that have participated in the work group, I think, are owed that of gratitude for just their willingness to do it. It would be easy to say, well, these are the principles that we agree to, but it's another thing to really translate those principles into real live language, and they have done that in this bill. And Legislative Council has done a marvelous job in capturing them as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Conklin. Questions for Ms. Conklin? I have a couple first, Mr. Conklin. Referring to Section 11 on page 8 and Section 20 on page 17, what I'm looking for is the self-triggering mechanism that would in Section 11 talks about the power to acquire and hold and execute contracts, and in Section 20 it says specifically in the language Oregon Community Power shall enter into negotiations. Is it your understanding, as this bill is put together, that it is self-executing, that there is no other individual or others who would be required to execute the provisions of this bill upon passage?
One thing to have
a bill, but another thing to actually initiate the action, and it seems to be self-executing. I just see if that is correct or not.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I believe that in many respects, as written, Senate Bill 1008 is self-actuating. It isn't self-actuating to the point of where it actually forms a bid, because while that's anticipated, it isn't exactly described how that would occur or who would do it. But at least with respect to such things as formation of the board, there's a timeline that's set into place and a requirement for the governor to appoint 120 days after the effective date of this act. So there would be a board. There theoretically also on the action of that board then could be activated a process to develop funding to proceed with due diligence and other steps that could be involved in forming a bid. So it would appear that this bill would in fact have triggers that, if passed, would move forward.
And then my second question, I'll open up to the committee, is, and we would look at this, I think, as we move through the House side. My only concern about this this particular issue, as you are all concerned, and we've had discussions as you move through this process about, time, the time element here. And under this provision, you have upon passage a 120-day, as you just mentioned, Mr. Conklin, period to nominate a member of the board. And by the time that board is in place, it could be many, many months confirmed by the Senate. And the board, as I read this, is the one who then initiates these provisions. And but between now and then, there is no governing body. And I just wonder if, as we move forward, if it would be valuable to look at a provision in this bill that set up a temporary authority upon passage to enter into negotiations that would then be succeeded by the board authority in this bill, so as to answer those critics of this work that it can't be done in a reasonable period of time. I just, any comment on that I would be interested in.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer with the Citizens Utility Board. I think to clarify the point, that is something we should look at.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Decker. Oh, actually, Senator Starr had asked. Sorry, Senator. Senator Starr had asked first.
I got a question. Gary, the list of statutes that apply and do not apply, can you provide that for us? I couldn't write fast enough to get those all down. I'd like to have that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr. I just received this from Legislative Council literally before the hearing started. In fairness to Dexter, I only asked him this morning for this too. So I'd be glad to provide it to committee staff so that you have it.
That would be helpful. And then I have a question about who you represent.
Mm-hmm.
You're speaking for Washington County. Do you have any fiduciary connection with ICNU at this point at all? or has that been transferred to another member of the lobby?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I no longer represent the industrial customers.
Okay.
Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just want to echo Dexter did really a fantastic job on these, and many times it was an enormous undertaking that we're not familiar with occurring, and many times he answered questions that we had. And so as we thank Mr. Cleaves, Mr. Eisendorf, Mr. Conkling, Ms. Dexter Johnson, and the whole work group, I would just echo that. And it occurred to me that he stayed here, I know, late. I got an email from him at 11:30 on a Friday night working on these, and so I hope he hears me thanking him for producing these. Gary, one of the questions that we've had is the ability to act, and that's certainly been kind of a clear path, and that's been a question that has surrounded Oregon Community Power as actually we had prior testimony just today. What is the clear path to action if you actually got this to the governor's desk? And I don't know if you'd like to comment or could comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, thank you actually for that question. I think it is, as it turns out, a very timely question. I agree with Representative Berger, who, when she testified, indicated that this wasn't about a race. It was really more about an effort to develop a credible offer. And at least from my perspective, Senate Bill 1008 in the city of Portland really come from the same basic core idea that there are advantages for ratepayers for the conversion of PGE to a customer-owned utility, and that as circumstances have moved on, that opportunity has looked better and better. So this isn't about a competition either. But looking at the situation as best as I can from the vantage point that I have, what we're looking at is a transaction involving a willing buyer and a willing seller. And the seller repeated what he's after yesterday in Portland, which is money, cash for creditors, which is understandable. That's his responsibility and his fiduciary responsibility. And a clean transaction, a transaction that can be made and closed without obstacles. I think it's interesting to evaluate the other side. What is a willing buyer? And a willing buyer usually is someone that has a fair value and looks at acceptable terms. And in evaluating a public ownership question, I think fair value is a question of do you have assurance that a fair bid will be made that will be responsive to the value of the utility and ultimately have the best opportunity for competitive rates, as well as do you believe that the people that are buying it are in a position to run it in the way that you'd like to run it and see it run and that you would have confidence in. And it is probably in this latter area that I think that the discussion between this option and the city has the most merit. Does it make sense to have a governance structure that doesn't completely fit your service territory? Or does it make more sense to actually use the public corporation statute of this state and design a utility specifically to run a utility that has multi-jurisdictional character and sophisticated assets like PGE? It boils down to nothing more than that. And at the end of the day, from my perspective, it's not how fast you get it done. It's how well you get it done, because in the end of the day, I think that's what will translate into a clean transaction. So I think it's no more complicated than that. I think that you, as I said in my testimony, have before you the most complete outline of a utility capable of converting PGE to a customer-owned utility that can both bid and operate the utility based under this statutory framework.
Any questions?
No, I think Jason wants to.
Okay. Oh, please. Thank you.
Should I wait? Or should I go
if you're responding to a question, otherwise I... Questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. I find it a little disappointing that, or maybe it's happening, that the city and the governor and this entity aren't working together. I think that the goal would be the same, and I think we're going on a collision course if all of a sudden people are taking a look at their own ownership issues or turf issues. And I truly, Portland is quite a bit further along in their goal or their process. This one is just beginning, and I truly wish that that somehow you could get together and work with each other and come out with one plan. And I don't know if you've thought about that or any work has been done on that, or get some comments, particularly from Senator Deckert and Representative Berger. Maybe that you're not ready to deal with that at this point. Anyway, I'm throwing that issue out.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Berger? Okay, Jason, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jason Eichdorfer with the Citizens Utility Board. I will keep my comments to a minimum. Gary has done an excellent job running through the bill. You have the matrix that I prepared on the bill, and as I was preparing it, it struck me that the bill is clear, it's clean, and it's tight. I didn't know whether it was proper etiquette or not to thank Dexter Johnson, but I was going to thank him anyway, so, and others have done that. He has done a remarkable job, and I really appreciate the patience of the chair and the committee for letting us put this together. Gary is absolutely correct. The city, I think, is well on its way in due diligence and putting together some important issues. I think this 1008 is as full an explanation of what that utility might look like, and so whether or not the legislature moves fully along this path, I absolutely believe that moving the bill along has a benefit, because I think ultimately one or the other or both may happen, and ultimately what we're really looking for is the regional public ownership opportunity. There are two issues that I think that still require some work in 1008. One is, if the city of Portland and this were to integrate somehow, more work would need to be done on 1008 to make that integration work. The other issue that needs some work is the public preference issue. Ms. Flicker was up here talking about the principle of holding public power customers harmless, and we can adopt that principle as well. The language in the bill that public power provided actually, I think, is a high likelihood of actually doing some harm to the PGE customer. It would actually essentially create a penalty for a public creation out of PGE, that the benefits from Bonneville actually would go down if this provision were still in there. So we need to keep working on this section, public power, and the work group, I think, need to keep working to make sure that there is no harm to either the PGE customer or to the public power customer. Mr. Chair, to Senator Starr's question about a public vote, I, in principle, would have no problem at all having the public vote on a well-formed proposal. I think the problem is that, as a de facto matter, that probably kills the deal. The time that the election would happen and the time necessary to meet Enron's needs don't work well, I think that requiring that public vote moves this from a bilateral deal, a bilateral arrangement, to one that would require condemnation. If we're looking for a way to get to public ownership, that through a bilateral arrangement, through a window that is not going to be open for very long, I think a public vote probably is a de facto death knell.
Questions? Okay. Ms. Cleave?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brad Van Cleave on behalf of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. I testified last week, so I won't repeat any of that. I just wanted to point one thing out that the Dash 8 amendments add to the bill, and that's in Section 18.3. It clarifies that PUC approval would not be required for Oregon Community Power to acquire either PGE or its assets. And I think this removes an uncertainty that may still exist with some of the other acquisition proposals. So that kind of addresses the clear path issue that Senator Deckert raised. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I have a question, since we have two attorneys, correct, on the end, the bookends here. As we look at the different scenarios of what the future of PGE will turn out to be, and I mentioned this in our last hearing, how this all initiated, and I remember the round table also in room 341 in our caucus room, as you recall, when we were talking about condemnation and that issue that was being before the legislature. And this all emanated from the Enron bankruptcy and where we really started having different thoughts about the future of PGE. And as that discussion came about, there was a real concern, again, about losing local ownership and also just losing local control. I mean, whether that's public ownership, as we're talking about here, but local or private ownership. And when the TPG offer came around, so much of the discussion was not only because a lot of people were certainly on the same page, including the Public Utility Commission, ultimately, that that offer was not sufficient to protect interests of the ratepayers and the public at large. And a lot of comments were made about the board that would be established, that Dr. Kohler was to have led. While they could make recommendations, the fiduciary responsibility, because they were the owner, was actually TPG. And that gave a lot of people great heartburn. And, you know, many words were put out that this was essentially a shell board, that the ultimate authority would be TPG. As we move to a public ownership, whether it be 10,008, or in this case, another the other option that we're looking at, of course, with that is the City of Portland. The City of Portland also has promised to establish a regional entity for a governing board. But the City of Portland will issue those revenue bonds. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't the City of Portland actually be the TPG? Wouldn't they be the owner that would ultimately be able to call the shots, just like the legislature would with 10,008? I'm just trying to think where the ultimate responsibility is here.
Mr. Chair, yes and no. I think the answer is
sounds like a attorney response.
Yeah, but this is a real answer. yes, in that the city would be responsible for the bond covenants, and so there would be the board that they would set up, as I understand it, would have ability to make a number of decisions, but up to a point, perhaps a dollar figure point, the city council would have to make a decision. The city council, I believe, would have to approve the annual budget, because they are the ones who issued the bonds, and they're responsible for the bond covenants, and ultimately they need to make sure that the assets are in good shape. So in that sense, I suppose there is that oversight. The no part is that I think there's a qualitative difference. Maybe not everyone would agree with me, but in the Texas Pacific situation, there was really a fundamental split of allegiances, where Texas Pacific was had allegiances to its shareholders, which are fairly can be directly in conflict with the customers. People can make their own decision whether or not to what degree the Portland mindset is different from the rest of the service territory, but there is not that shareholder ratepayer conflict.
Okay. Yeah, comments? Okay. Other questions? Senator Scar.
Thank you. Could
the three of you chime in for someone that hasn't focused on this in depth amount of time you have, and Senator Deckert and other legislators have, about what it really means to the average customer of folks that have a PGE meter on their home today, what it really means for this entity to be tied into Senate Bill 1149 regulations that you went to great lengths to incorporate into this bill. I just need I want the specifics. I want to know what that really means. Why is it in? What would be different if it wasn't in to the customers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, maybe at the point of the meter, you might not be able to necessarily tell the difference, but the provisions that were part of Senate Bill 1149 that dealt with, on the one hand, the ability to have a competitive market for larger customers, provides for those customers some competitive pressure relative to rates, as well as other energy-related contractual relationships that can be affected without directly impacting or negatively impacting other classes of ratepayers. On the other hand, there are provisions relating to public purpose charges, which were intended to encourage conservation and renewable resources that are also an important part of the mission of not only I think what we think of as investor-owned utilities, but customer-owned utilities, and certainly utilities such as PGE. There were also provisions relating to low-income heating assistance, which were critically important to lower-income Oregonians and ratepayers who face some very, very difficult choices between food and heating. So all the mix of those reasons, as I say, may or may not be readily evident at the point of the meter, but I think are important policy considerations that were in relationship to PGE's territory. And what this bill does is keep, as with many other existing arrangements, it keeps them in place. It makes no changes. Nobody has a better benefit or a worse benefit. It keeps them as they are. And the reason why you have to be specific is because there is an exemption in law that a customer-owned utility wouldn't otherwise be subject to them.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, John. All right, now we're going to hear more on the finance of this. Tony Fisher and Doug Goh and Ron Nichols, please.
My name is Ron Nichols. I'm Managing Director of the Energy Practice of Navigant Consulting, and the reason I'm here today is to try to address some of the issues that I believe came up in some prior hearings that you've held.
Thank you. We all our hearings are not private.
Pardon me. With respect to matters relating to how might this transaction come about, where do the customer savings come from? I believe there were some questions previously that arose with respect to the amount of rate base and what could be, what sort of things could be paid, and what sort of rate reductions could be achieved through this, and where does that derive from? And then comment briefly on what are some of the key actions and that would need to be made in order to affect acquisition by a public entity here. I've provided an overview of that. I don't intend to go over these details other than to the extent you like, I'll give an overview of that. And the reason I'm speaking about this today is our firm, and I particularly, dealt with what is a very similar type of transaction, and probably perhaps the only transaction of this kind of scale, of a public entity, particularly a state entity, acquiring an investor-owned electric utility, and that is the Long Island Power Authority of New York, which is a state-created entity, to acquire, through negotiated purchase, the Long Island Lighting Company, which at the time unfortunately enjoyed the highest rates, retail electric rates in the nation, not just in the state of New York, and went through the efforts as an integral part of that team to negotiate that acquisition and support that acquisition, and then subsequently worked on the independent consultants report that supported the what was in a $7 billion acquisition, a little over $5 billion bond issuance for the purpose of the successful acquisition of a LIPA, by LIPA, of the Long Island Lighting Company, and then the resulting reduction. So I've lived through that. I know the process. Had the pleasure of having similar questions raised by members of the New York legislature, types of things that you're going through right now. So I would hope that I could at least bring to bear some of that experience, and certainly be pleased to answer any questions with respect to that. Just briefly, here in terms of items I'd like to go over is just briefly the objectives, the source of savings, some of the key actions that could and should be undertaken in order to be successful. And then I've also provided separately a separate page for you there. I think there were some questions as to how large would a Portland General governmental entity be relative to other public power entities inside within the U.S. And I provided a table for you on that as well. I think the key are probably a lot of policy objectives that could exist that would go beyond what I'm going to discuss here, and I would leave that for the policymakers. From a financial and transaction perspective, the objectives would be to achieve lower retail electric rates and to achieve those immediately upon an acquisition. And you do have a unique opportunity here for what is really a permanent across-the-board rate decrease that is difficult to see how else that would occur. It also provides for, the objective would be to provide for further decreases for rates in the future compared to continuation of the status quo as an investor-owned utility. It also provides and positions utility for greater flexibility in power purchases, including the future of possible tax-exempt finance power supply sources that would reduce the power cost volatility. And I'd like to make one quick point in the numbers that I'll summarize for you here. Relative to one of the earlier witnesses and on their testimony with respect to concern about impacting other public power entities who purchase from volatile power, in our analysis, we have assumed there would be no change. And we have assumed no benefits associated with a public acquisition of Portland General from getting any greater share of monitorable power than currently exists through the residential exchange that Portland General customers have today. And in addition, one of the objectives would be just to simply enhance the business climate within the current PGE service territory through that rate reduction and the stability that creates.
Can I ask you a question just before you move on to the next one, because of your involvement with Long Island? And that's been a few years now since that happened. Could you tell me that as you look at the numbers, you know, whether it's the cost per kilowatt hour as opposed to when this was a private utility, and the natural progression when compared to other investor-owned utilities on the Eastern Seaboard, has the reduction in you know, the savings been realized with that as per what we're hearing about, with if this was public, you would naturally assume X amount of dollars, it's going to be less than it was before. And if we look at those numbers with Long Island now compared to when they were a private versus a public utility, and their costs versus other investor-owned utilities operating similarly, Is that accurate? Would those numbers reflect that?
They do, and we amplify a little bit on that. Long Island Power Authority had an added benefit in that it had had an exclusion under the 1986 Tax Act that actually allowed it to use tax-exempt financing for the acquisition. So it achieved an even greater savings. It achieved actually a 20% across-the-board rate savings. I'll compare those numbers a little bit when we get later here. They achieved those savings. They've maintained those savings. Over time, as fuel prices have gone up for virtually all utilities, the percentage savings has been less. But going to your question, how does this compare to other investor-owned utilities? The best benchmark for that probably is Consolidated Edison, which is their neighboring utility. Mm-hmm. And Long Island Power Authority still has rates that are significantly below Consolidated Con Ed, as they refer to it, at a time where it had rates that were higher than Con Ed at the time. So they have reduced rates, and they have maintained rates that are lower than the neighboring investor-owned utilities that encounter similar fuel costs and service territory costs.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to use your insight on that, since your background.
Sure. Let's look a moment just at the source of savings. The key sources of savings, and if you're looking at the presentation, there's page 4. It's clearly the lower cost of capital for existing debt and replacement of debt for equity through what would be a 100% debt-financed acquisition. This is exactly how Long Island Power Authority did it. It's not an unusual approach. It's a time-tested approach. And looking at lower future cost of capital. On going forward, anything that would be a future capital obligation for infrastructure, generation, transmission, distribution, customer service, vehicles, etc., anything that would be financed going forward could use, and I will certainly defer to counsel here, but based on working on other transactions, it would have the benefit of being able to use tax-exempt financing for those incremental costs, and that would achieve savings on a go-forward basis. Advised also by counsel that would have the avoidance of federal income taxes, which is a significant piece. We have assumed in our analysis that there would be no other tax savings. That is, there would be in-lieu payments made for any other state and local taxes, franchise fees, etc., in the analysis that we did here. And then there are potential synergy savings that could exist through if there was an arrangement in working with other utilities to provide some joint operations and maintenance, customer service, some of the backroom services, customer services and such. Those are additional savings that could be achieved, getting some additional economy of scale. We've not assumed any of those savings in our analysis. It turned out within the Long Island Power Authority that there was about another 1.5%, 2% savings that were achieved through that, but I've not assumed that in this analysis here. And I'm not going to go through all the detail on page 5 here, only to go to the question that I believe was raised in one of your earlier hearings of how could there be a payment on the order of, you know, say, $2.3 billion when rate base might be less. Actual rate base based on the most recent SEC filings for 2004. By PG&E indicates they are all in at about a net plan of $2.275 billion. We've assumed those numbers here. If you just simply compare a weighted average cost of capital and rate of return for Portland General of a little over 9%, we've assumed, quite frankly, pretty conservatively, I think I'm advised by Mr. Fisher of UBS, that he would think that the number could be even lower. We assumed a 6.5% average cost of debt. That in itself creates just about a $60 million a year savings, not just once, which is greater than what TPG was offering, but every year on a go-forward basis. Provided on the next page just the assumptions that got to that to that comparison of average weighted cost of capital. I don't worry with those details right now. So if you look at the preliminary estimates of rate payer savings overall, this table here on page 7 shows a comparison cost of capital. And then we're showing a range because this is all done with public data. We haven't had the benefit of due diligence. We haven't received any confidential information that Portland General Electric would have. But all in with cost of capital, the savings in federal income taxes, estimates of what future capital savings would be, we're seeing a range on the low side from about $87 million, roughly call it $90 million a year, to as much as $167 million per year each year, as compared to current and the status quo. And hopefully that addresses somewhat where those savings would come from. I think if you look on a go-forward basis, what are some of the key actions then, be it whatever governmental entity might seek to negotiate and acquire Portland General? The types of things that would make this transaction happen, and certainly I've lived through with the Long Island Power Authority issue and what we dealt with, is to minimize the ambiguity of the cost responsibility and the revenue recovery authority of the new government-owned utility. If there's implementing legislation that can make that even clearer, that helps. It certainly helps explaining it to rating agencies, to investors, to bond insurers, and to parties who are looking at recovery of costs. To get the support for that, to establish governance that can be broadly supported by stakeholders, not just from a political perspective. It's our experience from a transaction and getting comfort to investors who would be investing in the bonds for this transaction. Having that kind of broad support is certainly very helpful. Maintaining current state and local taxes to be equivalent and franchise fees equivalent, but no higher than the current situation, is an important aspect of it. And then in addition, certainly at least my experience was, an important fact, was to not create any significant change in the inter-class shift of costs and cost of service by virtue of the change. That is, you don't have major changes in subsidization of class of customer by virtue of just making the ownership change. That certainly is something that was done by the Long Island Power Authority. They took a change across the board that was important for the comfort for rating agencies, investors, and it's worked quite well for that utility. And based on that, we'd be happy to give you answer any questions. Oh, I would point out on this separate page showed a list of the larger public power utilities and put in there Portland General as to how it would compare. I didn't make any changes or reductions in Portland General's annual costs. I just used their cost today. It would actually be a little bit lower cost, certainly about 10% lower cost on a go-forward basis. But they would rank fourth in the nation based on megawatt hour sales, and pretty similar based on electric revenues as well. Salt River Project of Arizona being the largest, followed by Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the Long Island Power Authority, about which I've spoken, and then Portland would be the fourth largest public power entity in the nation.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, just one on timing. I've been asked frequently in the past few days, partly because the city of Portland is poised, or seems poised, is how long, if it follows the date, say September, how quickly could a state authority, or Oregon Community Power, have a pro forma in place in your mind?
Well, I want to make sure I understand your question. Assuming that effectively nothing happened between now and then?
Well, that you get the legislation that you need,
right,
obviously done,
right,
in the next 3 or 4 weeks, and then you get after it, and
okay,
you start putting your due diligence together and your negotiating team and actively working towards a pro forma.
The only reason I was asked the question is there was a question earlier about the timing for selection of a board, and in other words, assuming, putting that aside, that
all goes,
that everything started moving forward, I think in terms of getting a pro forma together and having sufficient due diligence, I would say initial due diligence to provide an offer, I think that matter it can be done in a matter of weeks. Typically, a transaction like this, in my experience, is you do some initial due diligence to make certain that there aren't large items out there. There are always potentially small things that could come up. You provide an offer predicated on that, and then given a specific time for doing final due diligence on details of condition of plant and the like. So I would anticipate that within, from a putting together an offer, setting aside getting stakeholders together, but putting together an offer could likely be done inside of a month's time. And then you would want to reserve for yourself some opportunity to do detailed due diligence just to make certain that there wasn't some not obvious major issue that would have a cost impact before that. And that's very typical of a transaction of this type.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Chairman.
Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, Representative Berger, members of the committee, Doug Goh at 1125 Northwest Cooch in Portland, or Carrington and Sutcliffe. I had the pleasure of appearing before the committee last week. Really am here to answer any questions with respect to the bond aspects. Both Mr. Fisher and I had suggested to Senator Deckert that it would be we thought it would be useful, given some of the questions raised by the committee last week in terms of project feasibility, to have Mr. Nichols available to present testimony today. And just to provide a little more context for that, these being revenue bonds and any of these transactions in terms of kind of the key players in terms of doing the diligence and presenting a financing to Wall Street, obviously you need an investment bank such as UBS, but you also need a consulting engineer / feasibility consultant such as Mr. Nichols' firm, and a number of our public power clients have worked with his firm, and obviously both in terms of the Long Island Power situation, which he has addressed, as well as the state of California's Department of Water Resource $13 billion financing. Mr. Nichols was involved in both of those. So I'd be happy, Mr. Chair, to answer any questions. Again, want to applaud Mr. Johnson for his efforts on the Dash 8 amendments. I think there are a number of improvements from a bond perspective. One item, I think, as a remaining in terms of a policy matter that I think the committee may want to address at some point, and that is, in addition to giving the authority to Oregon Community Power to acquire the assets of Portland General Electric Company, you may want to look at whether Oregon Community Power should be structured in a manner that potentially it could also acquire the stock from Enron. But with
I'm
that,
I'm asking that question right now. In a way, I mean, you don't know that, but I'm actually asking that question.
In terms of the structure, if you were to do that, the structure of this public corporation would be more along, right now it's something of a hybrid between a public corporation and a state entity. Throughout the bill there are references to this public corporation being an integral part of the state. If you were to follow more the OHSU model, it would be more in the nature of an independent public corporation, so that you did not run afoul of the state constitution prohibitions on the state owning stock or municipal corporation owning stock. There are some potentially differences, and be very candid about this, between OHSU's mission, as you know, and a utility, and so there would still be some legal issues to be addressed with respect to that. But I did want to just raise that as a policy issue that the committee may want to address. And we'd be happy to work with the committee to provide them our specific comments in terms of what amendments you would make to the bill. If, again, as a, purely as a policy matter, the committee and the people working with Oregon Community Power decided to proceed on that basis.
If you don't mind, could you be a bit more specific about that, because that is an issue here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the decision is we're not going to sell assets, we're only going to sell stock, you know, we've got constitutional issues there. Give me a bit more value of your learned experience of how that might be structured to be able to still accommodate the changing waters here.
Right. As kind of a crude overview, Mr. Chairman, you basically, under the state constitution, you don't want to be the state, and you don't want to be a municipal corporation. There are prohibitions on both. So in terms of specifically, one of the things that you would change is that you would take out all of the references to Oregon Community Power being an integral part of the state. You would take out the provisions where, in terms of the deposit of the funds with the state treasury, like the OHSU, they hold their own monies, they invest their own monies, and that would be another example of what you would do. It's not, frankly, I've kind of gone through the bill and marked it up. There are not that many provisions, but those are essentially the provisions that you would look at. So you're getting away from all the provisions that right now, and for good reason, if you want to have a state entity, that you have those references to it being an integral part of the state, to making sure that it's clear that it's an independent public corporation.
I see. Now, under that scenario, if it was going to be a stock purchase and maybe these changes were made,
mm-hmm.
would however we still be able to use the state treasurer in terms of having the bonding authority? Can we still use that like we do with OHSU?
Actually, in the case of Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in the case of OHSU, OHSU issues its own bonds directly. The state treasurer, with respect to advance refunding bonds, has oversight, as they do for all state entities and local governments, but otherwise OHSU. So in this case, I think obviously the state treasury has incredible resources and knowledge. I think one way that you could still access that knowledge would be to have express authority for the state treasurer to enter into a management agreement, a consulting agreement, if you will, and likewise for Oregon Community Power to contract for those services with the state treasurer. So potentially you could get to the same result,
mm-hmm.
but structurally you would take them out as a direct actor, and it would be they would then become an indirect actor.
I like your creative thinking. One more thing on that. Looking at the city of Portland's pursuit of this entity, and we don't know what the final outcome of any of this will be. We have heard, at least at this stage of the game, and the game always has many stages, but certainly the comment has been that Mr. Cooper, based on his responsibilities, says we're not interested in selling the assets, but maybe, but there's kind of a big maybe there. But we're really interested in a stock purchase. I mean, that would be what we're interested in. The state has the flexibility that you've outlined in terms of trying to meet maybe different scenarios. Does the city have any ability to meet that scenario if in fact, the word was you'd have to buy the stock?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first of all, let me say I'm not here today to comment on the city's. And
right. I think we're trying to get an overview of what all right. these, you know, what are the different pathways and obstacles that everybody right. faces here.
In terms of the city of Portland directly, they being a municipal corporation under the Oregon Constitution, they could not directly acquire stock. However, I think it's been mentioned in testimony here and reported in the press that, and that's my basis for responding to the question, that Oregon or Portland has looked at forming a nonprofit corporation that would acquire the stock. So I think that my understanding from what has been reported is that not directly, it's potentially the state could do here, or this independent public corporation could do, but I think that Portland, my understanding is, believes that they have devised a way to address that. I don't know the particulars of that, Senator Metzger, so I couldn't address the specifics, but I think that's an overview.
Thank you, sir. Questions for the witness? Yes, Senator Starr.
We've compared this to OHSU. Is there any comparison between Oregon Community Power and the State Accident Insurance Fund as a quasi-government agency?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, there definitely are some parallels. I think that and the SAFE offers some good examples. I think that there are some elements of SAFE that are different than OHSU. And OHSU in Senate Bill 2, as you may recall, when OHSU was formed, took some steps to not be exactly like SAFE, but I think that SAFE offers some of the parallels, but it's not just like OHSU isn't a perfect model. I don't think SAFE would be the precise model as well, but it does offer SAFE has some elements of being an independent public corporation. So SAFE also has some elements that would be more state-like, if you will, for purposes of the Constitution, that I think if you were structuring this that you'd want to look very much at the specifics. And so in terms of it being an exact model, I would say it's not the exact model that we would recommend. And I might say, Vice Chair Starr, that I think all of these issues in terms of, you know, the timing, if as a policy matter, this was something that the committee and those working with Oregon Community Power wished to pursue, I think that the legal research looking at the exact structure would need to be done in detail to make sure that this was a structure that worked for all involved. Let me also be clear in terms of our suggestion, just again as a policy matter, that you look at this. We are not saying this is an all or nothing. I think that in terms of what the bill currently does, in terms of giving authority to do an asset acquisition, you certainly would want to retain the flexibility to either do a stock purchase or an asset acquisition. So it's not an all or nothing proposition.
That's good advice. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Anything else to add? Sir? No?
I'm happy to answer any questions, sir.
Okay. That's all we have signed up. Thank you very much for that. That was very, very helpful. Committee, we're in public hearing at the moment. We have completed our discussion on this. I would be interested in comments from the committee as we contemplate going to the next step here this afternoon.
I've got a question that I don't know if somebody in the audience may have an answer to. It relates to the City of Portland potential acquisition. Is there any means by which the public could put the issue of the City of Portland purchasing PGE on the ballot and have a vote? Not having the City of Portland act, but could the citizens that are affected, either the ratepayers who are going to be affected or the public that the City of Portland City Council represents, they have any opportunity to gather signatures and by referendum or by some sort of measure put this to a public vote. Does anybody have an answer to that question?
Or if legislative council's ears are burning, that's a good question. We certainly know in the state system we do have a referendum on everything we pass. So is there anybody qualified in the audience to answer that question?
No.
Okay. Well, if legislative council happens to have their ears on, it would be interesting to get a response to that. And we'll hold on that question for a moment. Other thoughts from the committee about our issue here? Senator Deckard, what are you thinking about our next steps here?
Well, I'm going to surprise you, Mr. Chair, and tell you that I think this is a sound, good idea, and you have heard more testimony from me than you probably care to on this committee about this idea, but as Representative Berger and Senator Nelson and myself, along with the groups that you heard from ICNU to CUB to AOI, we wanted to provide a vehicle for, and there is the star of the show. Just we're not
ladies and gentlemen now entering the room, Mr. Dexter Johnson, the man responsible for many mutations of this bill. And thank you for stretching, Senator Deckard, as we waited for the ears that I knew were listening. Welcome. Did you hear the question, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Member Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. Senator Starr, the question was whether the city could refer.
The question, let me just repeat for the record. The question is, assume City of Portland acquires PGE. Is there a means by which either the citizens who the Portland City Council represent and theoretically are accountable to, or the ratepayers who will be impacted significantly by that decision, but is there any means by which either group, either separately or together or some other means, would have the ability to, via a referendum or an initiative process, gather signatures and quote-unquote overturn the decision of the Portland City Council?
So this would be after the acquisition?
I don't think that something that could happen, I mean, I guess theoretically you could try to do something ahead of time, but I'm not sure that they could do that as either. I guess I'd be interested in your comments on that process as well, a prospect.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, after the acquisition, this is all off the top of my head, and I want to put that out there first, but I could be wrong. But after the acquisition, I think the acquisition could not be retroactively undone. It would raise too many. There would already be a contractual basis for the acquisition, or an eminent domain basis for the acquisition, and that could not be undone by subsequent legislation, including legislation that's enacted by initiative. An initiative could direct that the assets be disposed of in some other manner. If Portland is directly the owner of the assets. If Portland acts through adopting some kind of ordinance that directs that the assets be acquired, and I'm not sure they need to do that, but if they did, that would be subject to petition and referral by Portland voters. I don't believe there is any mechanism in place by which PGE ratepayers could vote on whether or not the acquisition should go forward, the Portland acquisition should go forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Other thoughts? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1008, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1008. And Senator Deckard, I believe we have a -8 amendment that we have been discussing today.
We do, Mr. Chair, and I would move the -8 amendments.
Senator Deckard has moved the -8 amendments to Senate Bill 1008. Discussion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonasanti.
And I'll just reiterate, I would like to work, I want to see the process keep going. I think this idea intrigues me. Anything that's going to save ratepayers money seems like a good option. There's a whole lot more questions that I have, but I do want to keep the process going. But I would hate to see this becoming a state legislation versus Portland's. I mean, I just will reiterate, I don't want to see this become a conflict between what Portland can do, because I think they can work faster. They've got their ducks in a row a whole lot more, I think, than we do, and they can go ahead and go forward. But I would hope that we still could be in collaborative mode as we go forward and then as they go forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
Just on that point, because I think that raises a really critical point, and I think in some ways there's been maybe a little misinformation out there. Just on what you see before you in the Dash 8 amendments, it is a more detailed look at the governance structure. And if we're looking at, and I don't know if that's the accurate way of saying who's ahead, but we have the ability, and I've always argued that the state legislature is a good place to do it, because you have the conversations that have been occurring over at AOI as Ms. Brandis has hosted this work group. You've had those conversations occurring of what does the governance structure look like in writing in front of us, and that's something that we found that is unique about this proposal, is that it does have that. And just on the financing, I think Mr. Nichols provided good testimony to answer that the state does have that ability, though I would agree with you, and I think the governor certainly agrees with you, as his words yesterday, that the city, I have no doubt, is poised to act on the acquisition side, and I think they've said all along the governance is something that they have issues with, or it's a more troubling conversation for them to have, because they're 5% of the geography and 25% of the load.
Further questions? Okay. Senator Decker has moved the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 10,008. Why don't we do a roll call vote on this?
Senator Atkins?
No.
Senator Decker?
Votes aye.
Senator Bonasanti?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Metzger.
Aye. The Dash 8 amendments have been adopted, and the committee is going to be in recess for about 5 minutes. Business and economic development. Sorry for the delay. Just makes things more interesting. When we left, we had just adopted the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 1008. Senator Deckert, we have a referral. We have a referral on this bill, Senator Deckert, and we have talked to Senate President about that. Would you like to make a motion for removal of those?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move to remove the referrals to General Government and Ways and Means, and move the bill to the Senate floor.
Senator Deckert has moved to delete the referrals to General Government and Ways and Means. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
The General Government one, I think it's fine. The question I have is, we may have a revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact. Statement's not yet issued, and yet we're sending this bill to the floor without those answers. So do we have those statements?
They're in process. The amendments were given to both fiscal and revenue as soon as the Dash 8 amendments were ready this morning, so they are looking at those right now.
Is there, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there some contemplation that this would not have either revenue or a fiscal impact?
I think there are two things, Senator Starr, one of which at the time that it continues to be working will not have a revenue or fiscal impact, or if it does, then the House Ways and Means would have responsibility to handle that on that side. Senator Deckert?
And the other important point to note on that is that the fiscal was all around, it shouldn't have any revenue, obviously, but the fiscal was all around funding of due diligence. And so now we have deleted that from the bill, which removes that issue, because obviously these are revenue bonds outside the general fund completely. And so since we deleted that section on due diligence and decided to deal with that last, that would be something that the House Policy Committee would have to look at, but I would see no need for a Ways and Means referral unless you put language on it.
Okay.
So there's no general fund impact by this?
Correct. Further discussion? Okay. Any objection? Right, so ordered. All right, we have before us Senate Bill 1008 as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
I move Senate Bill 1008 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
I'm going to oppose the motion to send this bill to the floor. I appreciate the work that Senator Decker, Senator Nelson, Representative Berger, and others have put into this. But I think that what we're talking about here is an issue that's fraught with problems. And I basically am not supportive of public power and the opportunity that I see for politics to play a significant role in our power system, the power generation, the distribution of that. We're creating a political entity, and I think that there's some serious problems with that. I'm also not convinced that we have to do this today in order to preempt the city of Portland. I think that there's significant challenges to the city of Portland in their ability to acquire or purchase Portland General Electric. And so for those reasons, we heard the testimony today. There's interests that have been working on this that still don't have their issues resolved in the draft that's being reported to the Senate floor today. Clearly I understand that the issues are to continue to work that on the House side, and I understand that there's some sense that there's an urgency here and because the governor weighed in and on all those other things. But from my perspective, I guess just the underlying philosophical basis that this bill is based upon, I just have a problem with fundamentally. But I think there's a lot of other reasons to not be so anxious about moving this bill ahead today.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
I do
have questions, but I still want to be want to keep the process going. But I've already voiced them.
Senator Atkinson.
There's nothing personal. I will be objecting to this. We have heard months and months of testimony. It's the first time I've spoken out loud about my objections to this bill. I think it's terrible public policy, just philosophically. I think you could actually get it close. But I don't believe this is here. I'm sitting here counting some of the testimony we've heard between this bill and the mutual bill. We've heard that stockholders are evil. We heard today that we want to fix the conflicts between ratepayers and stockholders. I don't believe that's the role of government necessarily, especially when I can count SEC, FERC, PUC, Secretary of State, Department of Revenue, and City of Portland, who already weigh in on whoever runs this. I don't know why we have to weigh in. Originally this got started in January under the guise of does the state have a role, and I've sat through a lot of this, but I just don't believe that this is the right way to go at this time. And all the good work that my colleagues have done, it's again, it's nothing personal, it's just a philosophical, and the head of your party just weighed in yesterday and wants the city of Portland to buy it, which I think is not good public policy either. But I just don't think it's ready to go, and because of that, I'll be a no.
Thank you, Senator. I will make a few comments on this, and I very much appreciate my colleagues' comments from the Republican Party. I think, based on some of the comments that I made earlier last week and previously, I share a lot of the philosophical sentiments on this issue. I also, however, recognize that there is a compelling state interest to help determine what the future of this utility is going to be, because as a business and economic development committee, we are committed to the economic development of the state. And we do indeed have that 800-pound gorilla when we have a utility that is responsible for over 760,000 customers who are the economic engine of the state, and to look after their interests. Now, I believe, as I said last week, when this whole debate began a few years ago and commented at the time, and again last week, that this was all centered originally about trying to rescue a 100-year-old local company based in Portland, paying Oregon income taxes and serving well. I think we all received the comments from J.D. Power and Associates that they PGE continues to serve well, and in fact is one of the highest ranked utilities in the western United States, both on service and reliability, in fact number one in that category. And that is a situation that very likely the utility could be facing. Again, local control, based in Oregon, paying taxes, a good corporate citizen, and all that goes with that when you have a local corporation based in your city. And I, for one, would like to see that as the end result. However, I also recognize that that is going to be determined in large part by others. And I don't mean government entities, but by those who have fiduciary duties to creditors and how they are going to perceive the situation. And I do believe it is wrong for us to vacate a playing field if there is an entity representing only 12% of the power usage of this entity, for not the elected representatives of the state to be able to weigh in and provide a viable option, which I believe this group has done, and which there is continued work to be done. I do not believe the comments, for example, in the paper today to suggest that this state is not capable of doing this. I believe we are capable and can provide this as an alternative if, in fact, the private return of PGE does not materialize, which I have said and will say again on the record I would prefer. I believe this option should be out there. I think we have articulated, Senator, some of the issues that still need to be done. I believe they will be done, and a few of them were brought up today to make this bill even better by the time it returns to the House of Representatives. I think it is important. I think it is our responsibility to make sure that that option, and we represent more so than the city of Portland, represent these ratepayers, all these 766,000 ratepayers in this building. And I believe that option should be out there, and I think it's our responsibility to provide it. I appreciate the hard work on all this. Let's do a roll call vote.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Becker?
Votes aye.
Senator Bonas-Emerson?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Votes no, and serves notice of a minority report.
Chair Metzger? Aye. Senate Bill 1008 is amended. We'll move to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and Senators Deckard and Nelson will co-carry. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.